This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor, welcoming my colleague, Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, to comment on three capitals involved in the Ukraine conflict. With winter underway, the snow flew in Ukraine this week, changing the nature of the battlefield. But then again, this is not only about the Donbass and the Dnieper River Valley. It's also about the opinion in the capital of Moscow, the capital of Kyiv, the capital of Brussels, and other interested observers. We begin, however, with headlines from London, meant to be provocative, and they are. The headline is, Ukraine could reach Crimea by Christmas. The explanation, Ukrainian forces could reach Crimea by Christmas and end the war by the spring, according to Ukraine's deputy defense minister. The retired major general said it was possible that Ukrainian troops could step in Crimea by the end of the year. He said he wouldn't rule out the possibility of a black swan event within Russia helping Ukraine in the coming months. For an example, an unexpected political development affecting the Kremlin. But he said that even without such an event, the timeline for reaching Crimea was possible. Asked by Sky News whether the war would be over by February 24th, he said, being realistic, we will need some time, but my feeling is that by the end of spring, this war will be over. Professor, a very good day to you. The remarks by the deputy defense minister certainly would have made people smile in Moscow, but not a happy smile. Good evening to you.
Good evening. Well, I have to say that with all of the caveats that the deputy defense minister used, and I would use them too, it does seem to me that we are now approaching the end of this war, which means that we're going to face the challenge that is always even bigger than making war, which is how to create a stable peace. And I think also that within the next few weeks or months, we are going to see the replacement of Mr. Putin. Of course, this is something that only the Russians know how to do. They will do it in their inimitable way, and we will have to be sure that we don't get involved with it. If we look at what Mr. Putin has been doing, he strikes me as having lost interest in this war. On Friday, he met briefly with his National Security Council, and the clouds of rumor that are associated with an event like that suggest that they really aren't listening to him anymore. They don't heed him, and they don't really feel that they need him. And as far as anyone can tell, the day-to-day military campaigning in Ukraine is being directed by General Sorovikin, and one has to say that he has done a rather professional job in the last 72 hours or so, perhaps more, of moving a very large Russian force that was trapped in Kherson. He's managed to move them from the what I would call the north bank of the Dnieper, because it cuts across east-west Ukraine. He's managed to get them from being encircled in Kherson and elsewhere. He's moving them to the south bank of the Dnieper, where they've been deployed in a defensive line, horizontal defensive line paralleling the river, but about perhaps 50 miles to the south of the river, so that they're out of the range of Ukrainian 155 millimeter artillery. So this has actually been, it seems, a rather competently run operation. And of course, a competent Russian general is one who can make things happen, even when he has a very, very corrupt and a lot of incompetent body of people working for him, and a lot of incompetent ones. It is also reported that a number of bridges that would have enabled the Ukrainians to pursue the Russians south have been blown, but the Novokakhovka Dam, which is of great importance, it's very clear that that has been damaged, but there is a bridge, sort of a causeway right next to it, which is apparently intact. Now, these have all been professionally executed maneuvers. If we look at them, the Russians are behaving more like a well-run army. But if you ask where they're leading, they appear to point to an orderly retreat which aims for a final concentration in Luhansk, or the area around Luhansk, which is to say the easternmost corner, the sort of the lower right corner of Ukraine. And what strikes me is that the Russians, in making this defensive line that I've just spoken of, they appear not to be reinforcing the land bridge to Crimea. They're not concentrating forces around the sort of neck that then debouches into the Crimean Peninsula, but they are rather far to the north of that. And this suggests that whoever's in charge is planning an orderly, workmanlike abandonment of a failed operation, perhaps totally, perhaps after negotiation with some little piece. Now, if we conclude that Mr. Putin is no longer focused on this and that the professionals are saying, well, the best we can do is we've just got to do our best with what we've got, and we're never going to, that conclusion suggests two questions. The first is, what is going to be the succession to Putin? And the second is, are the Russians perhaps preparing to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat by some kind of a surprise offensive, this black swan event, something from the north? It's quite conceivable, for instance, that the Russians could invade if they had the equipment and the manpower and so forth. But if you just look at the map and forget about those questions, the whole western section of Belarus is wide open, and south of it, the whole western Ukraine is basically not full of troops because those troops are all to the south and to the east.
The puzzle, Professor, about where the Russians are digging in, they've claimed they're setting up defensive positions on the left bank, that's the east-south side of the Dnieper. Do you believe that's accurate, or are they just talking and pulling back farther?
Well, I don't really have any idea. I mean, I'm not privy to overheads and all the rest, but it certainly seems that if you look at the places where we have information suggesting that the Ukrainians have a pathway over the river or into the Ukraine, if you keep going, moving to the east, the Russians look better and better entrenched. So it may be that they're planning to concentrate their troops, some of whom who would come south from the Kharkiv area, and others who would come east from Kherson area, into Luhansk and the area around that, and say, well, we are capable of developing fortifications and a military position here that cannot be taken from us. The problem is that unless they can keep somehow out of the range of Ukrainian artillery, there is the prospect of another a sort of endless artillery barrage. And frankly, I don't think either side wants that. So I would say bear in mind that the southeast Ukraine may be the piece, piece of the pie that the Russians want to cut off and put on their plate.
A puzzle about Russia is the economy is sagging badly. And there's every argument to be made that the sanctions have started a process that cannot be stopped for many years, that we're looking at a profound damage. Is that a consideration? Because you say about the military, that isn't the whole story anymore in Moscow. Is that a consideration for the voices in Moscow about the war?
Well, I think it's tremendous consideration. I mean, look, here we are. We're living in the world of microchips, and everybody and his brother is now writing an article about, you know, who can make microchips and who can't. Well, Russia, and you and I remember when Russia was a confident power, confident not least in her technological mastery, the Russians can't make microchips. They made a decision a number of decades ago, basically to operate on an analog rather than a digital basis in electronics, and they buy their microchips, such as they are, from China. And those microchips have a failure rate of about 40%. And this is not to mention the eternal problems that Russia has. Russia does not have good soil. They don't have rich harvests. They have long distances. They have bitterly cold weather. And the economy, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was not by no means a model economy, in a kind of paradoxical way, that collapse has continued. Perhaps the most important reason is the failure under Gorbachev and Yeltsin to make the transition. And they came very close. They had a bill that was going to be passed that was called the 500 Days Program that had been conceived of by some brilliant Russian economists, but it got caught and it was never put in place. Yeltsin, of course, had terrible health and alcohol problems, and both he and Gorbachev supported Putin. And I don't think Putin has any concept of how to run an economy should be run at all. But I think my impression on my visits to Russia is that most recently, it was less vigorous economically. The economic life in the cities and towns was less strong than it had been on my first post-Soviet visit.
I'm speaking to Professor H.J. McIntyre, International Relations, and we've been talking about the Ukraine conflict from the Moscow point of view. One more detail. When we come back, in these last days, I've had conversations with a European correspondent for The Economist about planning for a post-war Kyiv, but it involves a post-war Moscow as well. So when we come back, what will Moscow look like after the shooting stops? This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.
Chances are you've been to the doctor recently, and you probably handed over your insurance, your ID, and even your Social Security number. Your doctor is just one of many places that has your personal info. And if any of them accidentally expose your details, you could be at risk for identity theft. LifeLock monitors millions of data points a second. If you become a victim, they'll fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/IHEART for 40% off. Terms apply.